It is an effervescent drink of many names and many claims. In the United States, we call it kombucha, and we drink up about $500 million worth of it every year. All that bubbly, buggy brew drinking leads us to ask, does kombucha heal what ails?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1065th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Elfin Cove who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Glad to be here.
Jason, are you a kombucha drinker?
I have been known to enjoy a sip once in a while, yes.
Well, good. That's the subject of today's show.
Nice.
Folks, here is a very interesting paradox about the food we eat. For a processed and packaged food to have a long shelf life, it can have no life. And so most of the processed foods we eat to live are essentially dead. And the deader they are, the longer they can live on the shelf life so that we eventually can come by and pick one up and eat it to live. So then along comes this bubbly, buggy brew called, among many other things, kombucha. I discovered kombucha one day when the refrigerator ran out of beer. And what's this? I asked. Kombucha, replied the daughter. It's full of bugs. You'll love it. Well, upon opening the bottle, I heard the gentle hissing of bubbles rushing to find their way free. The taste I found to be crisp, sweet, tart, and incredibly interesting. The daughter has since moved on in life, but the refrigerator has yet to run out of her kombucha. She was right. I do love the bubbly buggy brew, and so wonder, can kombucha heal what ails? Well, folks, we're looking for our guest today, who is the kombucha mama herself, Hannah Crum, president of Kombucha Brewers, an international author, and the author of the Big Book of Kombucha. I just spoke with her a few minutes ago, and we do have her on the line. Hello, Hannah, is that you?
It's me. Hey, Michael.
Oh, good. Turn off your radio, kiddo.
Radio's okay. Off.
Okay, good. Now we're tuned in. So, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program, Kombucha. What is Kombucha Brewers International? You're the president.
That's right. So we represent the commercial bottling industry around the world, and we formed in 2014 as a result of a need for the industry to start to come together over the issues that are surrounding our product. You know, there's a lot of misinformation and fear, and so, you know, by coming together and sharing our common interests, we're able to then work together to dispel that information, get quality information about kombucha out there, and of course support all of the hundreds of brewers that are popping up around the United States and around the world.
Well, popping up is a pretty good, is a pretty apt description of the kombucha industry, is it not? Because one of the words for kombucha, one of the titles, is kombucha mushroom tea. So that the fact that they're popping up all over like mushrooms is pretty apt.
Absolutely. Well, and mushroom is a term of convenience. Our product is not actually a mushroom, but think about in ancient times. Here you have this SCOBY or symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. It looks like this kind of white pancake, and you don't understand that it's made by microbes extruding bacterial cellulose from their cell bodies. And so you look to nature and you think, what does this look like? And they must have thought it looked like a mushroom cap, which is why we have that term of convenience, kombucha mushroom.
Hmm. So your description is pretty interesting. Bacteria extruding stuff, right? It's kind of like bacteria poop, right?
Well, it's actually, it's excreted from their cell walls. So their cell walls are spinning these nanofibers of cellulose. The cellulose then bonds together and it creates this skin. So one of the other terms for kombucha is zooglea, which means living skin. And so this skin then acts as a mothership that we take from batch to batch. It also acts as a lid in two senses. So first, it prevents other potentially harmful organisms from penetrating the brew. So it literally acts as a barrier on the top, preventing that from happening. And then it also acts as a lid in the sense that there's a secondary fermentation process that occurs below the surface of the liquid once the SCOBY has grown and has a thickness to it.
Mm-hmm. Is the SCOBY the stuff I see floating about in my kombucha jar?
That could be the SCOBY or the yeast. And so, as I said, symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. So the bacteria build the cellulose structure, and the yeast are the kind of brown, greenish, blobby things that are floating around in there. But when you're drinking a commercial kombucha, sometimes a new SCOBY will start to form, but it may not be the same density as the culture we're using when we're cultivating it. And so, you know, I lovingly call it a snot glob, or refer to it as an oyster shooter. You know, you just, the first time one touched my lips, I immediately spit it back out. I was like, what was that? But once I learned the benefits and the properties of it, like I said, I toss it back like an oyster shooter, so I don't even feel it when it goes down the hatch.
Right. Now, take us back a little bit to when you first became acquainted with kombucha, but I described my first experience with it. The daughter said, you know, you'll love it. It's full of bugs, and it tastes great. And it was, and it did. And so now I'm hooked, too. How did you become in acquainted with kombucha?
You know, I feel like it was kombucha kismet. It was meant to be. A lot of people come to kombucha because they have a health concern, and they've heard, you know, it also is called the tea of immortality, the tea of long life. It has a reputation for helping with all kinds of ailments, and I'm not saying it's a panacea or anything like that. We can get into the nitty-gritty
later. Yeah, we'll get into that later, but...
But for me, it wasn't that situation. I was visiting a friend from college in San Francisco, the hub of all groovy things, and they happened to be brewing kombucha, which I'd never heard of. So they have this box on a table with jars, and they're all covered with claws, and there's something floating in there, and they go, that's the kombucha. We didn't even taste it because it wasn't ready to brew, but that word, right, kombucha, 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 just sticks in your mind. Well, I went back to L.A., and this is in the early 2000s. So at the Whole Foods, there was already a big case of kombucha there. I grabbed a gingerade off the shelf, and before I even paid for it, I just cracked it open right there in the store. I took my first sip. And, you know, in retrospect, it was like the heavens opened, the lights shone down, the angels are singing, because literally every nerve ending in my body was electrified by those bugs, by the life that I could taste in this beverage. And, you know, a lot of people, their first sip of kombucha, you know, we get that kombucha face, like a little sour face, because it's a flavor that most people aren't accustomed to. And I was a girl drinking the pickle juice in the pickle jar. So my mom would yell at me, don't drink that stuff, it's so bad for you. But I love that kind of tangy, salty, savory flavor.
And a bit of vinegar, right?
For me. Well, that's exactly what kombucha is. It's a tea vinegar. But it's a light, it's lower in acetic acid than your traditional vinegars are. Your traditional vinegars are diluted to a 4 to 8% acetic solution, whereas kombucha is, you know, 0.5% to 1%. So it's a lot easier to drink more kombucha than vinegar.
And it tastes actually quite a bit better as well. So kombucha, it seems to have come from Asia, you know, in just looking at the etymology of things.
Exactly right. And, you know, we don't have concrete information. There's a lot of mythology about kombucha out there.
Which makes it fun, right?
It does, right? But we're also trying to take it out of the woo-woo and root it into real science.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think sometimes people can get, you know, they're like, well, this isn't real. This is just something that, you know, is what came from...
Came from the hippies in San Francisco.
Exactly right. But, you know, that's where yogurt came from, too. And, like, everybody eats yogurt now.
Yeah. And there it is. Well, in essence, kombucha is a living food, which is to say it has living organisms in it, much like yogurt and sauerkraut and other fermented foods, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And so those of us who like the that living food, this is a very convenient way of getting it. And
you're hitting something here, Michael, that I think you know, why is kombucha so popular? Why do people come back to it again and again? And I think we lack a lot of living and bioavailable nutrients in our current food supply. And the body, just as I had that instantaneous reaction to the kombucha, yep. many people's bodies, even if they don't like the taste at first, because, you know, so much of our diet is over-sugarified and people's homeostasis is out of balance and their tongue, you know, taste buds are out of balance. But when we start to consume these foods in this living form, our bodies are like, yes, that's what I've been looking for. That's what I need.
That was the exact sensation I had. And I think, you know, I introduced the notion of this paradox. For food to have shelf life, it must have no life. And so we end up eating a lot of processed foods that have no life, which means that we're not getting the life we need to live, or something like that. But today we're finding it with kombucha tea. We have the kombucha mama herself, Hannah Crum, president of Kombucha Brewers International, author of the Big Book of Kombucha, right back with all of your kombucha lore.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, it's called kombucha, but it's called lots of other things all the way around the world. Listen to some of these interesting names. Tea fungus, tea schwam, wonderpilz, hongo, kajnish, fungus japonicus, and tweekwas. Wow. Why is it that it has so many weird names? Hannah Crum?
It's been popular in many other countries before it gained in popularity in the U.S. So a lot of those names that you're describing are German, where it became very popular post-World War I.
It came out of Eastern Russia, which means it had close proximity to Asia, right?
Well, we believe it is a Chinese or Japanese or Korean in origin because, first of all, it's made from tea, which is where that product originated from China over 5,000 years ago, and it's fermentation, which we know humans have been doing since the dawn of time. In terms of concrete evidence, we haven't been as successful in sussing that out, but, you know, the most ancient myths point to it being around 221 BC. We don't necessarily know if that's true, but what we do know is that the Russians found out about it during the Sino-Japanese War, which took place in like the 1890s or so. But the interesting about that war is that it was the Japanese in China near the Korean Peninsula where this whole thing was taking place. And so did it come from the locals who were drinking it there? Did it come from the Japanese who brought it from Japan? So we're still kind of diving into that mystery to figure it all out.
Well, it seems like we've been brewing beer forever. So what is the essential difference between brewing beer and brewing kombucha?
Just the substrate, you know, and that's the difference between all the ferments. What's the difference is what is it you're using to ferment it? So in the case of kombucha, it's tea and sugar, you know, and these are products that have been available for a long time. Now, how popular have they been? You know, we see tea gaining in popularity 800 AD during the Tang Dynasty. Obviously, people had to have been drinking it prior to then before it could get popular. So we're really eager at some point to make our way to Russia and China and to dig into that information. I do speak Mandarin Chinese, and so...
Oh, how jila?
Day, hen hao. You also speak as well?
Idiar, kasha, wo xin sai shuwa de bu hao.
Oh, hai, hai, bu chua. Ni hai yo, ni de, kui bu chua.
So it would be fun to go to China to learn about teas and kombucha for sure. So at any rate, it seems to have migrated around the 1913 into Germany, and from there throughout Europe, and then gradually shows up here in the United States in the hippie commune in San Francisco or so. It's relatively new in the Western world then, only 100 years or so.
It's true. I mean, and, you know, think about yogurt's trajectory as well. It used to be something old people in the mountains ate, and they lived to 100. Of course, as soon as Westerners hear that, they're like, oh, let me get some.
Right, there it is. You know?
And then again, it made that same way through the ashrams and the hippie communes until it finally became a commercialized product, and now it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And we really see kombucha following that same trend. And, you know, some of the negative things about kombucha, I think, really just come from lack of understanding, not working with it, and you know, there's always some fear-mongering around things that people don't understand.
Well, let's talk about exactly what kombucha is. Kombucha mushroom tea. They call it mushroom because it mistakenly thought it was the mushrooms that was the active ingredients, but it was not mushrooms, was it?
That's right. It just kind of looked like a mushroom cap that, you know, when you see a SCOBY, have you ever seen one, Michael?
Yes.
They're beautiful. They're just this creamy white color, and they're smooth, and they're really soft to the touch, yet firm. You know, it makes sense that they would think it's a mushroom cap because it has that kind of similar density and luxuriousness to it. But the reality is that it's that bacterial cellulose that's being created with the yeast. And so some of the terms for it are like a near lichen, because in a way these organisms have come together to work together in a positive way. But we, as the stewards of the culture, have to maintain the balance, because the yeast and bacteria, although they're in symbiosis, symbiosis does not mean kumbaya. Symbiosis can also mean parasiticism and, you know, negative relationships
sure.
as well. But it just so happens to be commensal in this case. But again, we need to maintain the balance. And so when we're making it at home, it means always taking our starter liquid from the top of the brew as opposed to the bottom where the yeast bodies collect, or not simply draining it down to the bottom and then filling it up. Because over time, that will allow the yeast to dominate the bacteria. You'll have poor SCOBY growth. The flavors will be off and things like that. So there are a few, you know, rules or rules of thumb to follow with the process. But once you get those down, it's super simple.
So speaking of super simple, it's tea, sugar, bacteria, yeast, and water.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
Yeah. So if you can brew a cup of tea, you're halfway to being a kombucha brewing expert. It really is that simple.
So there it is. What about alcohol?
Alcohol is a preservative, and alcohol is a vital nutrient. You know, we have a negative perspective on alcohol because of prohibition and how we've seen it dealt with. You know, we treat it like a controlled substance in this country, as opposed to in, you know, like our European counterparts, where alcohol is a cultural thing that you learn from a young age. You learn how to respect it. You learn when it's appropriate to consume it and in what balance. And alcohol has always been our medicine. You know, ancient people would put herbs and things into alcohol that they couldn't extract through just boiling water alone. And then those nutritional properties were passed on to you when you consumed it. These were our tinctures, our cough syrup. So I think there's a misapprehension about alcohol. And in this country, we have a low threshold for taxation, but it does not mean that the trace amounts created cause inebriation.
So it does create alcohol. So in effect, the kombucha tea I'm drinking right now does have some alcohol in it?
Well, just like fruit juice has some alcohol in it. Just like, you know, there's trace amounts of alcohol in all kinds of foods because of that preservative nature. That alcohol gets created in order to prevent other microbes from colonizing it. Think about rubbing alcohol, right? We use mm-hmm. it to get rid of bad microbes from our skin. So it's serving that same type of protective benefit in almost any ferment that you're making. There are going to be trace amounts of alcohol present. So
now,
with that being...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, with that being said, it doesn't necessarily have that intoxicating effect that people, you know, people automatically hear alcohol and they assume drunk or they assume intoxication, and that isn't actually the case.
No, it seems to be just about the opposite to me, although, you know, it's just, it seems to be a real clarifier to me. You know, one of the things that really struck me when I looked at the label was the amount of sugar compared to the amount of calories. You know, a lot of sugar in, not a lot of calories out. What happened to the calories?
Well, the sugar gets consumed by the fermentation process. Sugar, yet again, another vital nutrient that we have ascribed negative qualities to because, well, we always say consider the source. You know, where is that sugar coming from? Is it a chemicalized high fructose corn syrup you're talking about? Or is it sugar cane, which is something humans have been using, again, for, you know, 5,000 plus years? So when we consume it in that living form, that's how our body derives the nutrition from it. And the same is true for the culture. So the sugar that we're using to brew kombucha, and for a single batch, a one-gallon batch, that's one cup. That sounds like a lot of sugar. And if you taste that sweet tea, in my opinion, it tastes terrible. It's just so sweet. But over time, we can taste how that sugar transforms from the sweetener, becomes a fuel source for the fermentation process, and ultimately is converted into healthy acids that support healthy liver function and things like that. So the glucose, that's one of the molecules of sucrose, it's fructose and glucose, is what makes our gluconic and glucuronic acids, and both of those acids have a really net positive effect on supporting healthy liver function and keeping the body in balance.
And therefore, the sugar is burned up in the fermentation, so if you use a lot of sugar, it has a lot of sugar, but there's not very many calories at all.
That's right, and that's because also think about like this, you know, when we think sugar, again, we're thinking of sucrose, but here they've already been broken into their monosaccharide components. It has a lower glycemic load on the body, and in fact has been shown through several research studies as well as anecdotal information to help folks who have diabetes or cancer or candida. So even folks who have sugar-sensitive conditions, they can drink kombucha. Now, this is, of course, provided it's been fermented long enough and has that tangier flavor to it.
Ah, the tangier. But you brought up cancer and you brought up diabetes, and I know that kombucha has a lot of claims associated with it. So when we get back from this break, I'd like to ask you, can it make the cure for all that seems to ail us? Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, folks, here's a little paradox for you. For a processed and packaged food to have a long shelf life, it can have no life. So most of all of the processed foods we eat are set to live are essentially dead. And so things happen when we do not get those essential nutrients through our body and things start breaking down. But hey, here's a brew that is said to at least be able to treat or build the immunity so that our bodies can maintain its health. It's called kombucha, which I think comes from the romanization of an Asian-Japanese term, perhaps. But here it is. Said to do the following: prevent and treat AIDS, cancer, diabetes, and so on and so on and so on. Wow. How does this all work, Hannah Crum?
Well, first of all, we want to, you know, again, take it out of the realm of the fantastic and root it into reality. And the reality is that we are nature. And what that means is that we need living organisms in order to thrive. This is why we worked in the dirt and we would get the bacteria from the soil. We would consume our food and it was more bacteria rich, especially the fermented foods. And so kombucha is one of these bacteria rich fermented foods that has nutrition in a living form that our bodies have evolved to instantly utilize and recognize. And when, like you said, we consider the vast majority of what people are consuming these days, they're dead, they're lifeless, the nutrition's been chemicalized in some kind of fake vitamin format, the body can't process that, and it doesn't derive the same amount of nutrition as when it consumes it in that living form. So does it, you know, cure all of these things? I don't know that it does that, but what it definitely does is come in and rebalance the organism, bolster the immune system, and give the body the tools it needs in order to protect itself and defend itself.
You know, one of the interesting things is when you look into the medical claims and the medical advice and the medical industry is that the medical industry itself, well, here, let me read this from Mayo Clinic. There isn't good evidence that kombucha tea delivers on its health claims. At the same time, several cases of harm have been reported. Therefore, the prudent approach is to avoid kombucha tea until more definitive information is available. Almost get the sense that they don't want you experimenting with anything that can keep you healthy so that you go to the Mayo Clinic?
Well, of course. I mean, they don't talk about how 11,000 plus people a year die from acetaminophen, and yet you can go out to any store and buy that. You know what I'm saying? So there's clearly a disconnect in our medical community with the foods that actually nourish us. And it's really unfortunate because we've shifted away from actually caring for beings in a way that nutrifies them, that gives them life, and instead we want them to be constantly taking more and more pills and slowly toxifying them so that more and more money can be extracted from them. And that to me is unethical and inappropriate. And I'm not saying that there isn't good work that's done by places like Mayo Clinic or that there isn't value to Western medicine. There certainly is, but clearly the trend towards pushing more and more people, taking more and more drugs that just have more and more side effects and symptoms is not the solution. And that's why I think people are returning to these traditional foods. They're returning to finding solutions from nature.
Well, with respect to the claims, the medical establishment says, you know, there are no scientific studies, no scientific proof that kombucha can deliver on its promise of taking care of all of these ailments that it's promised to take care of. But, you know, on the other hand, Hannah, there are no scientific studies that disprove the claims either. So essentially, there aren't any studies.
Well, that's not true. There's over 200 studies. And in fact, in the back of our book, we have an appendix that looks at symptoms that people say kombucha has helped them with. And every single one of those symptoms is tied to a research paper.
Ah.
The majorities of these papers are being written in India, in Serbia, in Tunisia, in Iran, in places that, you know, that have more of a vested interest in finding solutions that support health and don't require expensive drugs or treatments. And so the fact that they want to say that is just they're not looking. They're not looking hard enough. And in the few cases that they point to, there's never been a conclusive connection made to kombucha, and yet they want to harp on these one or two cases that maybe it was the culprit that never was proven, versus look at all of the people who suffer from injury due to taking pharmaceutical drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we compare those two things, where, you know, kombucha is way safer than any of those potential alternatives.
So it's kind of like tying all drug use to the person having had some milk when they were kids.
Right.
You know, so the tie is kind of tenuous at best. But what are some of the dangers, if there are dangers? What about drinking too much kombucha? Is there a danger of overdosing, of becoming too acidic, as it were?
It's not possible to become too acidic with kombucha. Just because it has a low pH doesn't mean that it creates acid in the body. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Just like the citrus fruits, lemon and grapefruit and all these things, even vinegar, it has a low pH, but when it hits the digestive system, it alkalizes, meaning it's putting nutrition and minerals back in. And that's what makes it different from, say, the acidity of a soda, where that's going to deplete the body of nutrition, and that will have a negative acidic effect on the body. But, you know, so it's oversimplifying these concepts and then not looking at how they actually support people. And here's the other silly thing about, you know, science these days, is that we ignore anecdotal evidence. Well, the whole reason that we even have a desire to study some things is because people have been using them for a long time, and clearly they've had a positive effect on them. In terms of what to look for, you know, our philosophy at Kombucha Camp is trust your gut. That means listening to your body and how your body's responding to something, and assessing that biofeedback. I mean, too many people are disconnected from their bodies. They don't know how to feel their bodies. They're putting garbage into their bodies, not realizing that's why they feel terrible.
Uh-huh. So, see, that's an interesting notion. I recently had an occasion to spend some time with some really highfalutin dowsers, you know, people who douse things. And divine things, as it were, with pendulums and whatnot. And a gal said, you know, the single most important thing that you'd have to do to be able to douse is you have to trust your gut.
Mm.
And it's just kind of what you're saying as well. So the importance of listening to what your body's telling you to do.
Well, this is, and we're so disconnected from our bodies, or we're taught to hate our bodies, or we're taught to, you know, not examine. Look, we're tubes. We're tubes that intake nutrition and output waste, right? But if we never examine what comes out of us, how do we know if what we're putting in us is appropriate, right? So because we have this disconnect on so many levels, it makes sense why people don't understand what's going on with their systems. But kombucha is an easy way to reconnect to that because, like you and I have both said, once you start drinking it, you have a palpable feeling to it. Now, it's not for everybody, right? Just like not everybody can have strawberries, not everybody can eat shrimp, not everybody can eat peanuts.
Yep.
So listening to your body and making that determination for yourself is really the crucial part of the process.
You know, another thing with respect to scientific studies, I can't understand why anybody would invest millions of dollars to scientifically study the efficacy of something that you can brew up in your kitchen. And so when we get back, that's what I'd like to talk about, is how do we can brew up some of this stuff in our own kitchens so we don't have to spend all that money for those jars of kombucha that we love so dearly. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. Today we're talking kombucha, and by golly, you're invited to join us. We're at 831-479-1080. Got any good kombucha stories? Love to hear about them. 831-479-1080 with Hannah Crum, president of Kombucha Brewers International and author of the Big Book of Kombucha. And you, have you ever been healed or had some positive things happen to you because of kombucha? Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about kombucha, the elixir of tea, sugar, yeast, bacteria, water. Throw them all in a pot and away they go. They pretty much take care of themselves, don't they, Hannah Crum?
They do. They're very hardy organisms. And if anyone wants a free recipe that they can download and use anytime, you can check out kombuchacamp.com/DIY and you'll find your free recipe guide there. But basically, a 1 gallon batch is super simple. We take 4 to 6 tea bags, preferably organic tea, and 1 cup of sugar.
Well, wait, does it matter what kind of tea? I noticed there are some black teas and some green teas. What's the difference?
You can use either of those. So all tea comes from the same plant, Camellia sinensis, but things that we call tea are also not tea, so like peppermint tea, chamomile tea. These are actually herbal infusions or tisanes, so these would not be acceptable for the primary fermentation. We'd only want to use green tea, black tea, white tea, oolong, Darjeeling, you know, anything that's an actual tea we can use. And you can combine them and mix and match them in different ways, and they'll create unique flavor profiles as well. Provided it's tea, also it needs to be unflavored. Sometimes when they're flavoring the teas, they're using essential oils or things that could be antimicrobial. So we always want to protect the health of our culture by putting the most basic type of tea in there with no additional flavorings or fruit and things like that. So 4 to 6 of those bags.
Well, I noticed that I have I go for the ginger kombucha. Was ginger an antimicrobial?
So ginger, so all of the flavored kombuchas that you see, those are being flavored in secondary for the most part. So secondary fermentation is what we do after the first batch has the sweet-sour balance we like. We then take out the mother culture, 1 to 2 cups of starter liquid for our next batch, and then everything else we can put into our bottle. So it's in our bottles where we make the fizz, where we put in those unique flavors. So then, you know, that's where you put in your ginger pieces or your fresh fruit or your herbs or spices, just anything that you like. And in the book, we have 260 flavor inspirations. And they range from, you know, super simple like fruits all the way to savory mushrooms to some Ayurvedic blends. So you can get super creative with the flavoring. But that happens in secondary, away from the culture. So should those elements have any antimicrobial properties, they won't be adversely affecting the culture.
There you go. Well, now, where do we get the mother?
Me, I'm a bacteria farmer. Well, the other place that you can get it is, of course, from a trusted source. It's always a trusted source. So if that's someone in, you know, who's making their own kombucha, so that would be a trusted source. Make sure you're always receiving at least 1 cup of starter liquid with the culture. And then there are also reputable bacteria farmers like Kombucha Camp, where you can find those cultures as well. Now, you do want them to be in a living form with the starter liquid. You know, some cultures we can dehydrate and they'll do fine, but kombucha, just a lot of its defense mechanism is present in that low pH of the starter liquid. So it's really crucial that it is in that living form.
What kind of equipment do we need?
Super simple. Gallon glass jar, That's really about it. A strainer, maybe a cloth cover. Now, it needs to be a tightly woven cloth, so cheesecloth is out. That will allow fruit flies to potentially get into your brew. And while they're extra protein, not a lot of people enjoy seeing those flies on their
cream. Right. So, there you go.
So we want to use a nice tightly woven cloth. That could be an old sheet, a T-shirt, or a tea towel, something like that.
Gotcha.
And then so we boil the water, and we like to just do a shortcut method. Because the yeast are temperature sensitive, like if you've ever baked bread or anything like that, and phylogenetically we're more related to yeast, and so the temperatures that they like are very similar to the temperatures that we as human beings enjoy. So we do 4 cups of water to steep the tea for about 15 minutes. Once the tea is steeped, we remove those tea bags or the loose leaf tea. And then we stir in our 1 cup of sugar. So the nice thing is that water's hot. The sugar is going to dissolve quickly. And again, an organic sugar is going to do better. Can you use other things like maple syrup, et cetera? Absolutely. But we don't recommend that until you're in, you have extra cultures, because they will reproduce.
Just the other day, and somebody was talking about using raw honey. For
so that
the sugar.
Not work with kombucha. That has a different culture called Jun, which we also have. And that organism is uniquely adapted to work with the bacteria present in the raw honey. Now, we could use pasteurized honey with kombucha, but not raw honey.
So then it's a different culture then.
It is, yeah. So it's kind of like a cousin of kombucha, but it is definitely uniquely adapted to work with the raw honey in a way that's different than the kombucha culture.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, so we want to use sugar. That's the traditional sweetener for kombucha, and ideally something that's like an unbleached sugar or that's organic.
Mm-hmm.
Once we stir that in, we stir in love, we stir in hopes, we stir in dreams, right? So love is that nutritious ingredient for the soul that is so often missing from our processed foods, but we stir that into our brew. Now we bring the temperature down quickly by adding cool water to fill the rest of the jar up. Now we leave enough space at the top for the culture and the 1 cup of starter liquid so that it has some breathing room at the shoulders of the jar.
Okay.
So it'll be it'll probably be 2 quarts and then some, but it won't be a full gallon that you're actually making in that jar. And then that's the very last thing we do is we put in the culture, we put in the starter liquid, and then we cover it with the cloth cover and rubber band. At this point, you can, again, say a little prayer or do what you like or just put it on the shelf.
Dance around it perhaps a little bit.
Exactly right, or put crystal energy. I mean, people do all kinds of fun stuff with their brew. And I think that intention, that positivity, it just raises the vibration. I mean, these are living organisms just like we are, and we respond to that kind of positive energy.
Sure.
So why not bacteria? Which is what we're made of.
Amen. Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Hannah Crum. She, the kombucha mama, the president of the Kombucha Brewers International and the author of the Big Book of Kombucha. And when we get back, I'd like to ask, you know, just how far we as people can take this before it all becomes a big giant corporation. It seems to me like we can do just about everything ourselves, which would be really cool. Right back. Well, folks, given the exigencies of the Food Safety Modernization Act, I would suspect the federal government would be looking down on any food that still has any life left in it at all, and especially any packaged and processed food like kombucha. And so I'm wondering about the difference between kombucha that has been pasteurized and kombucha that is raw. Hannah?
Well, the vast majority of kombucha is raw, and that's because we're really an industry of small family businesses, of passionate, artistic craft brewers. Most people who are brewing kombucha commercially today had some kind of health challenge. Kombucha helped them, and they were so inspired by it that they wanted to share it with their community. In fact, there is far more demand than there is supply. We have major companies receiving orders for double what they can actually deliver on. And we're also seeing major grocery chains starting to put it in bottles with their name on it, and almost everybody is doing it raw. And that's because there is this palpable relationship you have with kombucha. And really, that is what has driven the industry forward. You know, I don't know if you know, in 2010, we had a little bubble in time where Whole Foods took all the kombucha off the
shelf. Right, right.
and it had to be relabeled and reformulated in order to come back on the shelf. But where that might be incredibly detrimental to some industries, in fact, kombucha not only bounced back, but bounced back even higher. And that's just a testament to when people get access to foods that give them the nourishment they know their bodies need, they're not going to shy away from even the supposedly high sticker price. And, you know, I think it's worth the price you pay at the store because of all the time, effort, and energy that goes into cultivating this. Plus, again, so many, you know, it's very different when you have a syrup and a carbonated water in a bottle. Like, there's nothing to that, right?
Yeah, nothing there.
When you have to cultivate it and grow it and also make a consistent product batch after batch, that takes a lot of time, effort, and energy. So certainly we can make it at home, but I personally love drinking kombucha. I first started drinking it as a commercial brand, and that's really what got me excited about making it at home, was because just like in the craft beer industry, you go out and you try the brands, and then you go home and you make your own kind that you like, and there's really that fun interplay between the consumer and the manufacturers because of that craft nature to it.
Mm-hmm. And all those little bugs in the bottle are your bugs in the bottle.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, is like there's even a question about what's the definition of probiotics, right? It has been very narrowly defined by a few couple strains, or if you look at the WHO's definition, it's any kind of that benefits the host, right? An organism that benefits the host. And that's what we really see in kombucha. But it's also the healthy acids that haven't been pasteurized to death that are also part of that equation. And so that's really what KBI does, Kombucha Brewers International, is to help protect the integrity and the authenticity of kombucha so that we don't end up with just a bunch of, you know, concentrates in a bottle with a probiotic supplement added to it.
Well, you know, Hannah Crum, you have a very interesting jihad going, and I congratulate you on it and wish you the best. I think, you know, finding ways of putting life back into our foods is just another way of putting life back into ourselves. And by doing that, making all of our lives a lot better than they were before. So thanks for the efforts, and thanks for pointing the way to kombucha and living foods.
Well, and we're on the same team here, Michael. You know, we are nature. And when we consume these things in a living form, you know, this human hubris that we can do, you know, better living through chemistry, I'm not against, you know, advancements in technology. But when the evidence comes in showing that actually it harms us, I think...
There you go. Thank you, Hannah Crum. We just ran out of time. Thank you so much. Hey, folks, go out and grab a bottle of kombucha and live. Thank you.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.